Welcome to Critical Matters, a sound podcast covering a broad range of topics related to the practice of intensive care medicine. Sound provides comprehensive critical care programs to hospitals across the country. To learn more about our programs and career opportunities, visit www.soundphysicians.com. And now, your host, Dr. Sergio Zanotti.
Managing acute asthma exacerbations in critical care can be challenging and may lead to adverse outcomes. Extensive research and guidelines focus on the outpatient and ED management of asthma. However, the management of life-threatening asthma in the intensive care unit still needs to be fully defined. Today's podcast episode will focus on the critical care management of life-threatening asthma. Our guest is Dr. Haney Malamet, a physician trained in EM and IM and critical care medicine. Dr. Malamet is currently an associate professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine at the Cooper Medical School at Rouen University. Dr. Malamet is a master medical educator with a large social media audience. In the last years, Dr. Malamet has created a medical resuscitation conference called Resus X, which focuses on cutting-edge education and resuscitation in critical care. He also posts and curates a free resuscitation blog called Critical Care Now. Finally, Dr. Malamet's dedication to the art of presentation and slide design has led him to create a course for beginners and seasoned speakers called Keynotable. Haney is a good friend of the podcast and has been on several times. Haney, welcome back to Critical Matters.
Thanks for having me, Sergio. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Same here. So today we're going to talk about life-threatening asthma. And obviously, as a clinician who is trained in emergency medicine, internal medicine, and critical care, and who works in the ED and in the ICU, you get to see some of these very, very, very extreme cases of life-threatening asthma. So my question to you, Haney, is why should intensivists care about life-threatening asthma?
It's a great question because most of the patients that I think we'll be talking about today have already been seen in the emergency department. A lot of the things we'll talk about have already been managed in the emergency department. However, I have had a few scenarios where patients have come in and developed an acute asthma exacerbation. And then the other thing to remember is that anaphylaxis and severe asthma can sometimes share borders. And so you might have a patient who you're managing in the ICU and they develop severe anaphylaxis. And some of the things that we'll be talking about will be very applicable to these patients.
Perfect. And in terms of introduction, what are some relevant pathophysiology concepts of severe asthma that might be important for our discussion today?
I think the biggest thing to remember, you know, without going into too much detail about like mast cells and histamine, the biggest thing to remember is that these severe asthmatics, they're severely bronchoconstricted. And some of the traditional medicines that we start to use or we typically use in asthmatics may not work in these patients. And I'm speaking specifically about our inhaled agents like albuterol and ipratropium. Those agents might not get to the target mucosa because of severe bronchoconstriction, and we'll talk about some of the things that you can do for those people.
Perfect. When you first encounter a patient, the initial assessment, how do you evaluate the severity of their acute asthma attack?
You know, when I started training, it used to be doing peak flows on patients. And as I got on my career and the literature shown, it's just really more clinical. I mean, the patient with severe asthma, it's very, very obvious when you walk in the room. They're tripodding, they're retracting, they're speaking in one to two word phrases. You listen to their chest. They may have severe wheezing, or even worse, they just might have a silent chest. And all those factors go into the impression that this person is having a severe life-threatening asthma attack. It's time to get to business.
Now, you mentioned peaked expiration flows. Is there any value in tracking those, I mean, as we treat patients? Or they're just, I mean, when somebody is really in severe status of asthma, because it's just very difficult to get them?
They're first of all, difficult to get because you need a patient who's going to participate. And They're not very helpful in terms of the management. Again, this is going to be a clinical management where you're following the patient at the bedside and you're just relying on your exam and how the patient is looking. So I would rather not waste time trying to coach the patient to get some number that's going to be meaningless to me and start giving that patient therapy.
How do you decide if somebody needs to go to the ICU?
Well, in terms of a severe asthma exacerbation, it's really what happens after the treatment. If the person is on a non-invasive or they're requiring continuous nebulization, I need a nurse to be watching that person like a hawk to see if they're going to be decompensating. So short of intubation, you know, all the things that tell me that the person isn't out of the woods would lead me to put the person in an ICU.
And that is obviously a unique aspect, because some asthmatics might show looking extremely, extremely ill, but if they respond to therapy very quickly in the ED, they might not need to go to the ICU. But those who are not responding are the ones that really we should be worried about.
Yeah, there are people who, you know, they come in, they look terrible, they almost look like they're going to die. And if you're aggressive early on with these asthmatics, I've sent these people to the floor, which is always comical when you're talking to the hospitalist on the phone. They're like, wait, this person was on non-invasive, you gave epinephrine, they were on an epi drip, and now you're sending them to the floor. And in some rare cases, these patients can turn around pretty quickly. But I will say that, you know, when someone comes in who's looking so deathly ill, they're going to be with me for a few hours in the ED before even considering that hospitalist move. More often than not, they're probably going to go to some step-down level of care just to observe them for overnight or for the next 12 hours.
There's something called the Lindy effect, Haney. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically it's the actual length of anything predicts its actual half-life most likely. So, for example, they used to talk about shows in Broadway. Like if a Broadway show has been on for years, it probably will be on for another couple of years, right? And I think of asthma attacks sometimes in the Lindy effect. If somebody gets really sick really quickly, there's a good chance that you could get them better really quickly. However, those who've been festering for a couple of days and get really sick, probably gonna take a little bit longer. Is that something that you have validated or seen in your own experience?
I can't say that I have. To be honest, there have been people who've come in with severe life-threatening asthma who have even been intubated, who've really had nothing more than a benign asthma attack at home, or even just an acute exacerbation. So that sort of prodrome that we see in most other diseases, like someone with severe sepsis, you can track them back and see they've been sick for a few days before that. I haven't seen it consistently with asthma, but you've given me pause to think about it for the next couple people I see with it. So I'll get back to you on that.
Let me know. So let's talk about pharmacological therapy, and maybe we can start just to categorize. Obviously, when these patients come into the ED, a lot of things are going on, but let's just start with a framework of talking about what are the initial drugs that you would recommend every severe asthmatic get?
There are drugs that people are going to get, which are the sort of routine package of asthma that every asthmatic gets. And that's going to be continuous nebulization with albuterol and ipratropium. They're going to be getting steroids intravenously because they're in respiratory distress, even though the bioavailability and the mechanism of action arguably is equal to oral, but because of the respiratory stress, they're going to get intravenous. And then there's the magnesium dosing, which again has been controversial over the course of the past few years. But I think for anyone who's having severe life-threatening asthma, giving magnesium as a bronchodilator would be very prudent. So those are the medications that are given routinely, I would say. But I think the next thing we need to go to is the medications that we don't often think about as being associated with severe life-threatening asthma. And the first one of those that we'll stop and we'll talk about is using epinephrine. And we're talking about epinephrine intramuscularly in the anaphylactic dose of 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams IM, and then rapidly progressing to intravenous. And the reason why I think that's so important, and I when I see people who get intubated in the emergency department, I find that people are not aggressive about giving epinephrine. The reason why it's so important is because, remember, as I alluded to before, that albuterol, that ipratropium, is not getting to its target organ in someone who's a really tight, clamped down asthmatic. And so all that albuterol you're giving is maybe just hitting the trachea and the dead space. What I want to do is I want to get that beta agonist effect of epinephrine, and that we're going to give it intramuscularly and intravenously to get to target organs to break that bronchoconstriction.
And in terms of other intravenous beta agonists, the studies haven't really shown that they're much better than using albuterol, but epinephrine up front, like you said, is probably something that we should consider for those sicker patients.
Yeah, I think in Australia, you know, they have intravenous albuterol, and that's fine, but we don't have that. And terbutaline will come up as people will say, well, why don't you just use terbutaline? And I think terbutaline is just fine, but I believe that you should be using drugs in your department that clinicians and nurses are familiar with. And if you're saying that epinephrine is equal to terbutaline, why not use a drug that you use every day, you have a familiarity with, and you know the dosing and how to run drips? That's why I go with epinephrine. And there are studies that show, by the way, that you know, people will sometimes get afraid of epinephrine because they say, oh, the person's tachycardic or they're hypertensive. I don't want to make them more tachycardic and more hypertensive. On first glance, that makes a lot of sense. However, when you think about it, that person's tachycardic and hypertensive because they feel like they're going to die. And there's studies, and albeit from the 70s and the 80s, that show that for these severe asthmatics, giving them epinephrine actually reduces their tachycardia and their hypertension because those patients can breathe again and they don't feel like they're going to die.
And I think that probably what important take-home message here is that if somebody is really sick and is not responding very quickly to the initial therapy that you mentioned, using epinephrine early, right? In the first, mm-hmm. I would say hour of somebody being treated is probably the way to go. Is that correct?
Absolutely. The pitfall that I see is that people give some nebs and then they wait a little bit and they give some other nebs and they wait a little bit and they're hopeful. And we all have to have hope, but we also have to know the progression of the disease. When someone comes in looking like this, have a very low threshold to progress rapidly, because something we'll be talking about through the rest of this podcast is that these patients' respiratory muscles, they basically have a stopwatch when they hit the door. And what I mean by that is they're going to fatigue at some point. And so I would rather be aggressive way up front with that person while those muscles are fatiguing so that we get some hope that we don't have to intubate this patient. If you wait too long and do some of the other therapies that are not as aggressive, even though this person has an aggressive disease, they're going to fatigue. And even though those steroids and everything else might kick in a little later, it might be too late because the fatigue has set in. And I reminded myself to tell you one more thing. When we said continuous nebulization in the front of the podcast, I mean, they really have to be making a lot of smoke in the room. Like if I walk into someone's room and it doesn't look like a college dorm room filled with lots of smoke, then I know they're not getting enough continuous nebulization. They need to be putting out a lot of smoke in that room, a lot of nebulization for me to know that we're maximizing our nebulization effect.
And let's just, before we move on to airway management, dissect a little bit more the usual medications to make sure that everybody's on the same page. So like you said, I mean, when we start with a beta 2 agonist, which is albuterol, you use them as continuous nebulization. So you're giving them 1, 2, 3 in a row, right? One after another. And like you said, very aggressively. That's the way you would start.
Yeah, I get like before respiratory comes down and gets a continuous setup, you know, you just take as many of those DUNEBs, you put them into the nebulizer and you just let it go. And that's why I said, you just got to make smoke. People are so concerned about, let's put a neb in and let's see what happens. You put as many of the DUNEBs in, the beta 2 agonist, the muscarinic, you put them in and you just let them blow because you know that you're going to need more. And continuous is really the way forward. This is just a temporizing measure.
And there's been a lot of studies about the bioavailability of nebulizers versus meter dosed inhaled albuterol. But I guess mm-hmm. in this setting, if for delivery continuously and to just make sure that it works, we always go with nebulizers, correct?
Yeah, it's a great medical student stump question, right? You know, it's like, you know, what should you give for a person who comes in with an asthma exacerbation, like the non-life-threatening person? And you say, yeah, there's no difference between meter dose inhaler and continuous nebs. But with meter dose inhaler, you're having patient participation, just like you're having with peak flow monitoring. Here, the person's just trying to stay alive. And so now you're going to tell the person, I know you're breathing at a rate of 40 per minute, but I'd like you to squeeze down on the pump and take a nice deep breath in and get the medications. It just doesn't work out that way. So go with nebs and don't try to be too academic about things.
Perfect. What about steroids? I mean, that's also the bioavailability is the same PO or mm-hmm. or IV, but we always start with IV in these sick patients, and some of these patients might eventually get intubated. So I think it just makes sense. What is your go-to dose and drug? Does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's going to be intravenous. You're correct. There's no difference in bioavailability. The mechanism of effect takes 4 to 6 hours to work. So why are we in such a rush to get the medications in intravenous? Again, it's just a respiratory distress point of view. So, you know, give them the solimedrol, give it intravenously, and then move on to the next step. Because again, that's now in their body. It's going to take hours to work. You got to keep moving on to the next steps and not think that that medication is what's going to save this person in the short term.
You mentioned magnesium, and you mentioned that there's been a lot of controversy, or I would say literature that is inconclusive. But my take, and correct me if I'm wrong, Haney, is that probably giving somebody two grams of magnesium IV over 15 to 30 minutes, whatever, when they come into the ED with severe asthma, check that box out and move on, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I would even give more magnesium. The funny thing I see about magnesium is people are sometimes afraid to give too much magnesium, and they're like, I don't know, 2 grams, their level is normal. I don't want to give any more. 4 grams, that's crazy. But then they forget the days when they did their OB rotation and they were taking patients with preeclampsia, and those people were on magnesium drips, and you were running around hitting people with reflex hammers that hardly ever get hyporeflexic. So my point is that with normal or even suboptimal renal function, magnesium is extremely well tolerated. And giving them aggressive magnesium dosing may be the thing, in conjunction with everything else, that helps turn this patient around.
Excellent. And obviously, as we are discussing, this is an acute respiratory illness, and airway management is going to be very important. So the drugs that we give are straightforward, and there's really not a lot. I mean, you under the sun, I think a lot of the challenges of managing these patients, Haney, is that we have to make decisions based on clinical information and not necessarily on numbers, right? And that's where you have to be, I think, very, very, very attentive. So let's talk about respiratory support. Is there a role for high-flow nasal oxygen?
I would say no. The person that we're talking about here should not be getting high flow. To me, it's a waste of time. There's not respiratory support to offload those respiratory muscles that are working.
Would you use non-invasive, and when?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I'm glad you brought this up, because non-invasive should be one of the first things that you put on your patient when they come in. Now, we need to talk about this and take a pause, because some people will say, well, wait a minute, asthma is an expiratory problem. It's not an inspiratory problem. Why would you give somebody non-invasive when they have an expiratory problem? That's just to support an inspiratory support. And it all goes back to that concept that we started with we need to support those respiratory muscles, because again, I imagine this imaginary stopwatch that clicks when they hit the door and they're going to fatigue. But if I can unload their respiratory muscles and support their respiratory work, I might be able to push that stopwatch out a little further. I may be able to spread out that time that I have with them so that they have a little bit more time for those medications to kick in, and then maybe they don't go into respiratory failure. So I hope that's clear to everyone who's listening. Again, it's not to fix the expiratory problem. It's just to offload their work of breathing so that you extend that muscle life, if you will.
And I think that also something we'll talk about a little bit later, but there's increasing data that pre-oxygenation with non-invasive or even high flow when you use it might be a positive for patients that need to be intubated, especially those who need to be intubated very quickly. But we'll get there in a second. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about Heliox. So Heliox's been around for a long time, back and forth. But what is your take on Heliox, Haney?
It's a tough one, because we should say, for everything we're talking about in life-threatening asthma, there's very limited data, because this is a very hard population to study. So with that being said, Heliox has been looked at, and the data is kind of meh in there, meaning there is some evidence that says that it might help, and there's some evidence that says it makes no difference. You know, asthma is a small airway disease, and in theory, Heliox should not help. It's really a large airway, like a trachea, main bronchus type of thing, where the laminar flow is going to be very helpful to deliver medications and ease work of breathing. When you're talking about all the way down at the terminal bronchioles, there's so much turbulent flow that Heliox is not going to help. So I always ask my respiratory therapist, you know, is this something that you have quickly available? If they say, I'm the only therapist on, I have to go down to the bowels of the hospital to try and find these tanks and bring it back, I would say I much rather have you at the bedside with this patient. If we have lots of resources and the ability to go downstairs and get the tanks, I might bring it up and give it a try for the person. But, you know, it's all a resource issue for me. The evidence for me is kind of meh. If I have it available, let's do it. If it's too much work to do it, we have other things that work better with more evidence that we can do for this patient.
I think with Heliox also, the idea on paper makes a lot of sense, right? So I think that's why it's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
But the studies, like you said, have been inconclusive. And that's also part of that is because this is a very hard-to-study population. So getting any studies that have a significant number of patients is very difficult. The other thing that I want to mention also that sometimes people forget is that Heliox, in order to work, has to be 70% helium, 30% mm-hmm. oxygen. So if you have a very hypoxic patient, which sometimes occurs, you lose the benefit of Heliox as you increase the oxygen. So that's just something to keep also in the back of your mind, right?
Excellent point. Yeah, if you have somebody who's already desaturating, like let's say this is a pneumonia on top of a severe asthma exacerbation, you're going to lose your amount of FiO2 to be delivered.
So the big question, I guess, is when should you intubate a patient with severe asthma?
That's a great question. And, you know, it's kind of an evasive answer, but I love this answer. And I got this from an emergency physician named Mel Herbert, who runs a podcast called MRAP, and his pretty funny. But he says you should never intubate a severe asthmatic unless you absolutely have to. And it's like, it's a nonsensical, it's almost like a Yogi Bear answer, but it actually makes a lot of sense. You should do everything that you can not to intubate an asthmatic, because as any intensivist knows, the hard work actually starts after intubation with managing these patients. But to say that you should never intubate an asthmatic patient would be a fallacy. So we have to be able to look at the patient and have some objective evidence that the patient is now starting to dip down, that's starting to take a turn. And once they take that turn and you've done all the things we've talked about, which are maximal therapy, you have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and say, look, I did everything. I had non-invasive on early. I went aggressive with the epinephrine. They're getting continuous nebulizations. They're getting steroids. They're getting magnesium. Heck, I even put Heliox on them. And this person's starting to fail. This person is telling me that it's time to intubate. Because if you wait too long and you maintain the hope that something's just going to kick in, then you're going to wait too long. And now you're dealing with the crashing asthmatic airway, which is an airway you definitely don't want to be involved in.
That really is a perfect Zen koan, right? You should never intubate an asthmatic patient unless you absolutely need to. And I love it.
Right.
But I think it is very important, right? Because we have both, I mean, probably heard of cases where patients get intubated, they go into cardiac arrest and they die.
Mm-hmm.
And these are young patients, and that's not very frequent, but it's a very dramatic case that for those who have seen this probably is always something that they will remember afterwards. So let's talk a little bit about once you decided, and one of the things that I find interesting is that we love ABGs, right? ABGs in asthma.
I'll go on the record as saying that there is never a reason to get an ABG in an asthmatic patient. In fact, if you're sitting there poking somebody in an artery while they're struggling to breathe, you're a bad human being, because there's nothing to gain by getting an ABG on a severe asthmatic. The oxygenation, you can look up at the monitor and see what the pulse ox is. You can, the PCO2, it's irrelevant. It's all clinical. You're looking at the person. But if you really need to know, which again, you don't need to know, you should do a venous blood gas on your patient. So I'm very adamant about ABGs wasting a lot of time, torturing patients, and delaying an ultimate decision. The decision to intubate an asthmatic is 1,010% a clinical diagnosis.
And what are some of the telltales that you should pay attention to? So you talked about some of them at the beginning, but I think also changes, right? So if this, if the pattern of speech is changing, if the way they talk is changing, right? If their level of consciousness is decreasing, even so slightly, those are the things that I think should cut your attention, especially considering that this population in general is going to be a younger population. Any other things that we should pay attention to?
No, I mean, I'm glad you came back to it because I wanted to. Like, people are going to say, well, you said don't intimate an aspect unless I absolutely have to. What it, for the junior faculty or maybe the fellows listening to the podcast, what is that tangible thing that they can look at to know it's time? And you basically nailed it. You have a person who's tachypnic and breathing at 35 breaths per minute, and now they're starting to breathe at, you know, like 25 breaths a minute. Their sats start to dip down a little bit. They start to head bob a little bit. You have to kind of rouse them up. Those are signs that you are entering the intubation zone. Those are the signs that you're not turning back from. Typically, when we see COPD patients, we try to increase the tidal volume or the respiratory rate, and we try to turn them around. But these are patients that are not turning. They've already declared themselves, their muscles are fatiguing, and now it's time to take their airway.
Let's talk about the intubation procedure, Haney. Once you decided to intubate, obviously one of the things that I've heard you say in talks is that this is not the type of intubation you give off to somebody who's learning, right? So absolutely, first and foremost, the most experienced person in the room takes control of this airway because you got to get it quickly and you got to get it the first time. How do you think about your pre-oxygenation and positioning and ET tube size?
Well, going back to your first point, anytime I have a patient come in with life-threatening asthma, I know that the resident on the shift or the fellow with me is going to hate me by the end of the shift. Because if I take the airway and I'm the most senior person in the room, there's no way they're touching that airway. And every second counts once you push paralytics, which you should for these patients, because they're going to desaturate rapidly. They may develop a respiratory acidosis very quickly because they've been blowing off all that CO2. So it's got to be the fastest person in the room. And if there's an anesthesiologist that happens to be walking by and I know that they're better than me, even though I'm a very proud person, I will hand off that airway to them because this is really first pass success. And we'll talk about that maybe a little bit down the road, but I had to address that. It is so vitally important. This is not a teaching tube. This is the time when you put your big attending pants on and you go in there and you do the intubation. When it comes to pre-oxygenation, I think you've been doing that all along. You've done non-invasive early. You're going to go to 100% if you start to get the sense that you're going to intubate them. So perhaps their FiO2 is like 40 or 50 or 60. Now you crank it up to 100% and make sure you get full denitrogenation of the alveoli. Positioning for the person is something that I'm actually going to wait for until after the paralytics are pushed. So I will keep the person bolt upright at 90 degrees. And if it's time to intubate once the paralytics are pushed, I might intubate this person actually semi-recumbent at a 45-degree angle, getting up on a stool and then doing it from above. And then the tools that we're going to use are also important because I'm a big video fan, and this is a situation where you're either going to use your hyperangulated or your standard geometry video laryngoscopy. Having multiple tubes available to you, you know, your 8 for a male, 7.5 for a female, but also having smaller tubes because if you get a look at the airway, you got to get the tube in. And so have multiple sizes right in front of you, ready to go.
And in terms of tube size, also obviously aim for the bigger tube that you can put in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because these patients might, first of all, have airway resistance and bronchoconstriction, but also might need bronchoscopies down the road for lavages.
Excellent point. Yep, absolutely. Always go for the biggest one in the asthmatics. For all the reasons that you said, you're going to have a lot of airway pressures on the vent. So try to minimize the amount of resistance that contributing to the airway pressures.
And you mentioned paralytics. So let's talk about drugs now. So this is obviously an RSI situation.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do?
The thing that I should have mentioned a little earlier on is ketamine should be part of your initial medical management. So let's just go back in time a little bit when we were talking about the NEBS, the steroids, the magnesium, we talked about epinephrine. Ketamine in subdissociative doses can be actually very, very helpful for two reasons. First of all, ketamine is a bronchodilator. It doesn't get enough respect as a bronchodilator. So giving it is another type of muscle relaxant that can cause bronchodilation. But the second reason why ketamine can be so important is when these patients come in, they feel as though they're going to die. And so there's a fair bit of anxiety that comes with their respiratory distress, and that's making their tachypnea worse. And with tachypnea, we have shortened expiration times, right? That's just the natural phase of things. The faster the respiratory rate, the shorter the expiration time. And asthma is a disease of expiration. So giving ketamine really has a two-pronged effect. The first is bronchodilates them. And the second, it just takes that edge off the patient so they breathe a little slower, maybe flowing those respiratory muscles. Now, I'm not saying that, you want to give the patient any sedative that comes in. I've seen people give Ativan or even the fentanyl just to take away that respiratory edge. The nice thing about ketamine is it doesn't suppress respiratory drive. But let me get back to your question at hand. What medications are we using? I would induce this person for the intubation using ketamine in our dissociative doses now, not the subdissociative doses we talked about before, in our dissociative doses. And then I would use full dose paralytic. I'd use rocuronium for this person because I want this person to be completely relaxed when we go to intubate them. So I'm going to push those medications. I'm going to wait 45 seconds, and then I'm going to lay that patient back just a little bit, get on my stool, and try to intubate them with the head and the bed elevated.
Excellent. What are some pitfalls to avoid during that process or immediately after we intubate them?
The first thing is, and this goes for any intubation that you do, whether it's an asthmatic, a septic patient, head bleed, whatever, is not calling for your post-intubation meds to be in the room. So as I'm asking the nurse to go pull meds, the meds I ask for are my induction meds. I'm asking for my paralytics. I'm also asking for a vasopressor to be at the bedside because you never know when that person is going to develop post-intubation hypotension. But I'm also asking for my post-intubation medications. I'm asking for my analgesia. I'm asking for propofol, another great bronchodilator, by the way, and I have them in the room. And that's another pitfall because then you have the person who you just intubated, and sure, they're paralyzed, they'll be easy to ventilate, but we don't have our sedatives on board. And there's an awareness that comes with that, but there's also the fact that you're not getting another bronchodilator on board. Other pitfalls with intubation, again, I would say is the continued, the continued attempts at intubation. So let's say the most senior person goes to intubate and they don't get the airway in. There's this reluctance to go for a surgical airway after a few attempts. People will keep trying to get the airway. And what's different with this patient versus other patients is that they're not easy to bag. There's a lot of airway resistance. These patients can be extremely difficult to bag. So you're going to have to get a very good seal on that person in between your intubation attempts. And you're going to have to use a little bit more force to bag the person. You're going to have to squeeze a little harder. You don't have to squeeze the entire bag in like you see some people do during a code. You're still going to just squeeze a little bit of volume in, but you have to use a lot more force than you normally would to overcome the airway resistance. And those are some of the things, I'm sure there's others we can talk about, but those are the things that come to mind with that question.
And you mentioned bagging, right? So one of the things that I've noticed, and I want to your take, Haney, is that once they're intubated, adrenaline's high, everybody's excited. I've seen people bag very quickly and very forcefully. And that's also going to, I think, lead us into, when we talk about mechanical ventilation, what should be the approach here? Can you talk, maybe give our RT listeners a couple of tips there?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, RT, but even physicians. And sometimes physicians are the worst offenders because you get the tube in, you're so proud of yourself that you got this difficult tube, everyone's sweating, you're sweating, and you're just, the excitement sets in, you're just bagging. And as we said before, asthma is a disease of expiration. And so you have to slow down that respiratory rate, and you have no feedback yet. When you get on the ventilator, we're going to talk about ways that you can see how much flow there is in the expiratory limb. But now you just have to go with kind of going down to like 8 to 10 breaths per minute, being very deliberate about counting those Mississippis and getting that person to bag slow. And, when I'm the person supervising, those are the things I'm watching after intubation. I'm watching the person bagging like a hawk because that can actually lead to air trapping and barotrauma. And that not only can lead to some worsened respiratory function, but there's also a hemodynamic problem that we haven't talked about yet with severe asthmatics. And you puff up that chest, they can actually drop their pressure on you. And that just comes from dynamic hyperinflation, essentially a compartment syndrome of your chest.
And I've heard you talk about this, and maybe this might be a good place to discuss it. Let's say that you're intubated somebody, you're in the immediate post-intubation period, or even if somebody's on the vent and they have a cardiac arrest, what do you do first?
The very first thing you should do in the person who has asthma, who went into cardiac arrest, or even a severe COPD patient, you have to think about the likelihood. Do you think this person now had a coronary lesion that led them to have ischemia to their heart? No. The likely explanation is that they've had decreased venous filling back to the heart, and this needs to be decompressed. And so the very first thing you should do is think about disconnecting the person from the endotracheal tube and pushing down on their chest to decompress that chest. Now, I want to be very clear about that because people think decompress the chest and that means doing a needle thoracostomy. It doesn't mean that. It means just getting the air out of those dynamically hyperinflated lungs, get them back to a normal volume. And I've seen in a couple cases, people get return of spontaneous circulation with just that maneuver. Now, the patient is also at severely high risk for developing a pneumothorax in those situations. So after you get the person reconnected and you're bagging the person, my advice is still to bring the ultrasound machine over and make sure that there's no pneumothorax, because that is a real possibility for these patients that we're talking about. But the first thing I would exclude, and the easiest thing to exclude, is just decompressing that chest by pushing gently bilaterally on their anterior chest.
Let's move on to mechanical ventilation. So let's say that you decided that you had to intubate. You took all the precautions that you mentioned, Haney, got the tube in, things are moving forward. You also mentioned that you like to sedate these patients. So analgesia, propofol is a great drug to sedate these patients, or even ketamine drips. And here, I guess the goal is not to have them interacting with us, but to go deep, right?
Go deep. Yep.
So you put them, you put the appropriate sedation, and now you have them on a ventilator. Let's talk about mechanical ventilation in the severe asthma. What are some general goals, or how some general thoughts of how you would do it, and what might be some, just to give people a point of reference, Haney's usual starting point?
Because I'm not leaving this person's bedside anytime soon, the respiratory therapist is going to ask me for some generic settings. And I'll say, you know, give me a respiratory rate of 10. I want to get 6 cc's per kg. And I'm usually going to go for a volume mode just for the simple reason that I don't want there to be any like pressure cutoffs, you know, with the ventilation. But, you know, certainly you could use peak pressures if you want to. But what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to stretch out the expiratory limb as far as I can. That's the first tenet of managing these patients. I also want the ability to decrease my eye time, which means I want to crank up my flow rate. I want the ability to get whatever tidal volume I'm in, I want to get over a shorter period of time, because less time in inspiration is going to add to the amount of expiration that we have. And then I'm going to go with a lower tidal volume, as I said, 6 cc's per kg, sometimes lower, because the less air that I put in, the easier it is to get out. So that's my general cookbook answer. But then after those settings are on the ventilator, I'm turning my attention to the vent and I'm watching the flow scalers. And what I want to see is I want to see that expiratory limb, that flow, come all the way up to baseline before the next inflection point. Because if we're breathing too early or we're triggering the vent too early, we're adding to that dynamic hyperinflation and that air trapping, and we need more work to do. And sometimes I'll just dial down my respiratory rate while watching that expiratory limb until it gets as close as it can back to that zero flow baseline before the next breath is delivered. And I'll pause there and just make sure that I delivered that clearly.
I think this is an important concept, right, of dynamic hyperinflation. Before we dive into that a little bit more, and you did explain it very clearly, Haney, what's your philosophy on PEEP? And this is obviously tied into dynamic hyperinflation, but it's very different than what we do in ARDS. I just want to see, I mean, what your thoughts are.
Yeah, this is something I've kind of bounced around with, you know, for the past couple of years. I think PEEP is important, but it's not something that we're going to be relying on for this person. So we don't have to go and drive up the PEEP for this person who is deeply, deeply sedated, because we don't have to worry about this person you know, initiating a breath as we would if this person was more awake. And we're talking about the concept of, you know, intrinsic PEEP here for this person. And that's a concept that we could talk about later in the podcast or maybe a different time. But in this case, I'm not going crazy with the PEEP. I'm just going with a standard 5 of PEEP for lack of a better number. I'm actually interested to hear what your thoughts are, because I've talked to a lot of people about this and the concept of PEEP. You know, are you really, are you splinting open the terminal the terminal airways by giving PEEP? I don't think so. I think the person is splinting them open on their own because of the dynamic hyperinflation. But I'd love your thoughts on that.
No, for sure. And I think that, like you said, I mean, the concern here is that the dynamic hyperinflation, and I would say that where I fall, and this is not based on randomized trials, but after speaking to a lot of experts and also experiences, 5 or below. So I have sometimes mm-hmm. even gone lower, 3. But I do think that the concept of looking at your airflow and making sure that we are getting back to baseline, there's no air trapping or what we call auto-PEEP, is extremely important, because in many other situations, you might set the ventilator and forget about it for a while, doing other things. But in this situation, it can get ugly really quick, right? Especially when you first intubated the patient. So I really believe that the concept of dynamic hyperinflation and understanding how to look at your waveforms to make sure that you are delivering the best possible type of breath is important. And you emphasize already, Haney, and we'll review for our audience, these patients need deep sedation, sometimes neuromuscular blockers. They need low respiratory rates. They need low tidal volumes. They need an I to E ratio of 1 to 4, right? More if you can, which means that you're going to have a very high flow rate. And you need to make sure that all that is working. Now, one of the consequences of doing this is that you might have a low minute ventilation that might lead to mm-hmm. hypercapnia. But I guess that we all agree that that is something that you will gladly accept if you can protect the airway other ways.
Yeah, I got to bring this up because one of the residents came up to me recently and they were at another hospital and they were pretty upset that they had a patient, just like we're talking about here, and the respiratory therapist was fighting them because the pH for that patient was like 7.2. And they were doing everything that we had talked about here, and they were trying to ensure that the patient was ventilating, but the respiratory therapist was upset that the pH wasn't closer to 7.4 and was fighting the resident on this. And the resident, you know, their initial reaction was like, I'm doing something wrong. This therapist knows something that I don't know. But we have to be, you know, very deliberate about saying, I don't care about the pH if it's greater than 7.2 or maybe even a little lower, and we can talk about that gray zone there. But what I really want to do is I'm ensuring that the patient's getting ventilated. That is the thing I care about the most. So education is really important if you get a junior respiratory therapist who's like, I don't know, why is this so acidotic? Why are we going there? Well, that's the reason why. We're getting a little bit of acidosis to benefit the fact that we can ventilate and keep this person alive. And one more thing that we should point out with your respiratory settings that we didn't say deliberately is that you may have the therapist come back, especially a junior therapist who hasn't seen many of these cases, coming back and saying, you know, our peak pressures are alarming. You know, what do you want me to do for the settings? And typically what I'll say is like, I want you to increase that peak pressure alarm, because we're going to expect high peak airway pressures because of the intense resistance that's present in those airways. And you may have to increase the airway pressure alarm to 100 or even 120. And you have to be careful here. You can't just do it and not watch the patient. You're going to have to go back and seriously look for pneumothoraces. But sometimes that's what it takes for the machine to be able to deliver that breath. But if it hits that peak pressure alarm at the standard setting, you may not get any breaths at all.
Yeah. And I think that's a fair reminder for our listeners, a review, that when you look at these pressure alarms, right, when the peaks are going up, but the plateaus are not, you're usually thinking of airway resistance. So in an asthmatic patient, that is expected. And it can also be used to gauge progress. You would hope to see over time as you're treating these patients that peak airway pressure goes down, right? The second thing that you mentioned also, which is a high risk for these patients, is barotrauma and pneumothorax. So if all of a sudden you have increase in the plateau pressures, right, at both the peak and the plateau, you should be thinking of pneumothorax. You should be thinking what else is going on. And I think that should prompt some further investigations for sure.
Yeah, well said. Well said.
So let's talk about the refractory life-threatening asthma. When you've done all the things we mentioned, Haney, and you're still going down in the wrong direction, is there a role for ECMO, for extracorporeal CO2 removal? What does the literature say about that right now?
Yeah, we'll talk about ECMO now, but I do want to also mention inhaled anesthetics, which can be helpful. And I've actually had one patient in my career who I've had to take to the operating room to deliver inhaled anesthetics just for the fact that we couldn't ventilate the patient. Anesthesia was very upset, and they'll never be happy to take a person to the OR just to administer inhaled anesthetic, but that can be the game changer. And in that particular case I told you about, that can break. Now, there are some devices that are coming on market that will actually allow us to deliver inhaled anesthetics in the ICU through our traditional ventilators, and those are coming. But let me go back to the question that you asked. You know, there's two types of mechanical support that are known. The first is extracorporeal CO2 removal, which arguably this is the reason why this person got intubated, because they can't keep up with their CO2 clearance. Oxygenation is just fine. And those devices aren't available in the States yet, but are in Europe. And the literature that I've read with them have been very, very good in terms of putting a essentially 14 French catheter, essentially just a dialysis catheter, and just clearing out CO2, just scrubbing CO2 off while they're getting oxygenated. But if you don't have that available, then using ECMO, VV ECMO, venovenous ECMO, is the way to go. And we've had quite a few patients who have been at our hospital who've done very, very well for their severe asthma just by getting ECMO.
So clearly, obviously, the literature is still looking at this. And like you said, we don't have any randomized trials of putting severe asthma who's about to die on ECMO versus not ECMO. But when you look at at some of the registries, right, the survival in these patients with asthma on ECMO is going to be higher than ARDS just because of the nature of the patient, right? They're usually healthier, but it might be an option for those who have access to ECMO, and just something to think about. And I did want to go back to the inhaled anesthetics, but you did mention this, and just to remind our audience, the reason why you can't do it in most ICUs right now is because you need a gas scavenger system to get rid of the inhaled anesthetic gas, right? So that's what they have in the OR. But like you mentioned, for a young person who you think is really going to die, it might be worth trying in an OR to pay attention, because we might have devices that will allow us to do that, to deliver these in the ICU in the near future. But like you said, this would be like really a last resort kind of salvage therapy. But because of the properties that these inhaled anesthetics have of bronchodilation, they have been described in case reports as being something that can save somebody's life.
Yeah. I mean, I'd make the phone call to anesthesia as I'm calling the ECMO team or the referring hospital, right? I wouldn't make the call to ECMO without at least giving that a try. And luckily, I work in a center that has all of that here. But imagine you're somewhere in the community where you don't have access to ECMO. Like, how are you going to get that person to the center? And sometimes getting to the OR for that treatment might not only temporize and get them better, but it might even reverse the disease altogether and avoid transport. So I think it's an important consideration to at least try. I can't say all your anesthesiologists will say yes or be happy about it, but it's definitely worth a try.
Excellent. Any additional considerations that you want to include before we close, Haney? I think we've had an excellent discussion of a very dramatic presentation that, fortunately for most intensive, is not something we see every day. But when we do see it, I think using the right clinical judgment can really make a big difference.
The things that I would say are, and these are just based on some of the pitfalls that I've seen in my own cases or just managing other cases, is the first is you have to be aggressive early on. If that person's coming in speaking one to two phrases to you, this is not one where you say, hey, let's just give them a couple nebs and see how they turn around. You need to be parked at that patient's bedside. Be aggressive, get the non-invasive on early, use epinephrine or some parenteral beta agonist on board early, You need to identify when this person is starting to fail on you and intubate them before they become a crash intubation. And remember, intubation is a very high-risk procedure, but if you are experienced and you use the right drugs, then you should be able to get through. And then don't forget about after intubation. That's when the real work starts. That's when managing the ventilator, being aggressive about permissive hypercapnia, watching those expiratory flows. If you do all that stuff and you're aggressive, hopefully your patient will do just fine. But those are the things that I see commonly missed, because we think about asthma as being something that should just respond to our typical therapy. But this is not a typical disease. This is a pulmonary disease, but it's also a hemodynamic disease. That dynamic hyperinflation can cause some severe hypotension shock and, as you've even said, cardiac arrest. So act early, act aggressively. And then also get your, you know, consultants involved, you know, get anesthesia involved. If you think you're going to wind up doing a surgical airway — we didn't talk about surgical airway, but if you think this is going to be a high risk airway, then get a surgeon to the bedside to be ready to correct the person during your intubation. But I've said too much. Hopefully that was a good synopsis of everything. And hopefully you have the tools now and your listeners have the tools to take care of the next severe asthmatic that comes through those doors.
Absolutely. But you've been on the podcast before, so you know you're not off the hook yet. So I would like to close with a couple of questions that are unrelated to the clinical topic. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
So the first question relates to books. Is there any book that has influenced you significantly, or that really has impacted you lately, or a book that you have gifted often to other people?
I think I've mentioned this book before, but it's a book and a TV show, if that's okay.
That is perfect.
And that's, and I'm now that I said, I'm sure I've said, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And that's a book I read almost once a year, or I listen to an audiobook once a year. But the reason why I go to it is because we just started — we're almost done with it, but we recently started watching Ted Lasso. And have you seen Ted Lasso?
I've seen parts of it. But I read a lot of interesting articles about the leadership lessons from Ted Lasso. So I definitely have to see all of it.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So the reason why I'm sort of I'm using that show is because I also don't read as much as you do. So I feel kind of embarrassed. So I have to use something else. But Ted Lasso, what's amazing about it is a couple things. The first thing that's amazing is it's a guy who knows how to make people feel good. A person who's a great leader, who knows how to use the right words, who hardly ever takes anything personally and makes everyone around him better just by being a good person. And so it touches on a lot of the aspects within How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I think that when you're working in a busy ICU where there's a lot of stress, especially post-pandemic, where people are already going through the stuff every day, being that type of person that walks on the unit, that's always bubbly, that's always happy, that brings out the best version of people around them, is so important. And while it's not really an ICU topic, it's a life topic, I think where we work, in the environments we work, with the toxicity that we sometimes seeing, those two things, that book and that TV show, are a must watch and a must read. In fact, I'm watching Ted Lasso again now, going back, and I'm taking notes as I'm watching it, because I've incorporated a lot of the things that Ted Lasso has said in what I do every day. So it's a definite recommend.
Perfect. And we'll definitely put links in the show notes. The second question is, what non-medical YouTube, TikTok, internet, video, or TED Talk should every intensivist watch?
I knew you'd ask a question like that. And I don't actually have a great answer for you, because I watch so much goofy stuff. What I can say is there's a couple of dad joke kind of TikToks that I watch and come up on my feed. And I like them for two reasons. The first is I just think it's funny. And anytime I can break my day up with some humor and put perspective on things, it's a good thing. But the second thing I've started to do is I've started joking around a lot more with my families and my patients. Now, I don't like to walk into the room and be a goofball. I don't want them thinking that a clown is taking care of them. But I'll sometimes say, do you want to hear a joke? And 9.5 times out of 10, someone's going to say yes. And even though the joke might not get a big bellow laughter, I'll sometimes get a smile and a chuckle and say, hey, thanks for that, doc. I was having a bad day and I appreciate the effort. So I just put a whole bunch of TikToks with dad jokes on them. And I just, now it makes me happy. And hopefully I'm making some patients and their families a little less sad during their day.
Perfect. So I guess this is the perfect segue for me to give you an ICU dad joke. Would you want to hear a good ICU dad joke?
Any day.
Why is it a bad idea to play hide and seek in the ICU?
I don't know.
I see you. Okay, Haley, let's close.
Well done.
let's close there. And you obviously been a big proponent and very involved with what originally was hashtag FOAM, Free Open Access Medical Education, but really promoting education through different channels, right? And I know that this is something that you're very passionate about. So where can our listeners find your content and where can they interact with you?
So on social media, I'm at Critical Care Now, all one word, Critical Care Now. On YouTube, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, but they're all slightly different content that's tailored towards the page that you're on. So that's a place where people can find some of the free open content. I'm staying away from X these days just because it's weird. So you may not find me on much there anymore. But I have a newsletter that I put out that has a ton of my content that we do every single week. It's all free. It's open access. If they're interested in that, they can go to resusx.com. And then the upper right-hand corner, there's a newsletter that people can sign up for. And then every week, you basically just get an email dropped in your box that go 7 or 8 things that might make your week a little bit more interesting as you read through. And as I was preparing for the show, there was one more thing that I'd like to offer to your listeners, and maybe we can make this link available. But because in the spirit of free open access education, I'm going to give everyone access to our conference that we did last year. If they just go ahead and click on the link and they can sign up for that, they get the conference, they get to watch it. Sergio was actually faculty at the conference and has been for the past few years. So you can even see Dr. Zanotti talk a little bit about critical care and leadership. Always great talks for IU, by the way.
Haney, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much. We'll definitely include all those links for our listeners, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
I can't wait. Thanks again for having me today.
Thank you for listening to Critical Matters, a Sound podcast. Make sure to subscribe to Critical Matters on Apple or Google Podcasts and share with your network. Sound's transforming the way critical care is provided in hospitals across the country. To learn more, visit www.soundphysicians.com.